Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Corbett Report. I'm your host, as always, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you from the sunny climes of Western Japan here on this 20th day of October, 2013. But as you will have noticed by now, this is not a regular episode of the podcast. This is another edition of the Questions for Corbett series. As I mentioned on New World Next Week last week, I currently have some family visiting from Canada, visiting the newborn son for the first time, so we are very busy with a lot of different things, as you can imagine, and so I am not quite able to fulfill all of my obligations here at the Corbett Report while the family is visiting. So for the next week, things are going to be a little bit slower at CorbettReport.com, but I did want to get this Questions for Corbett done because, again, the questions just keep piling up and up and up and up, and there's no way that I could possibly answer them all unless I did a daily edition of this Questions for Corbett, which I can't physically do. So if I don't get to your specific question, please don't take it personally. I do have to just make some decisions and decide what to answer and what not to answer. As always, the best ways to get your questions in are through the contact form at CorbettReport.com and or by leaving a YouTube video with hashtag QFC in the title, and or using hashtag QFC on Twitter to direct a tweet towards me. Those are the best ways. And in fact, Twitter user Rahul Varshni has come up with some good ways of getting in touch, including using something like Soundboo and SoundCloud, Audioboo and SoundCloud, that should be, to record yourself asking the question and leave a question that way. That would certainly be acceptable as well. So lots of different ways to get in touch. One way not to get in touch is through the personal messages in YouTube. I never, ever, ever check my personal messages in YouTube, so please don't send me anything through there. At any rate, let's get into this today, and we really do have a strict time limit of half an hour today because we're going to go see a Japanese soccer game today. So let's see how many of these questions we can get to. But before we get into the questions today, I want to actually do something completely different. I want to start off today with not a question, but a comment of sorts. I want to also use this Questions for Corbett series to highlight positive things, positive changes that people have made in their lives and through the work and the information from CorbettReport.com, because at the end of the day, that is ultimately what this is about. This is not about me being some sort of guru that you ask your questions to. This is really, hopefully, about making positive changes in our lives and learning from others how to do so. So if you have an interesting story about a way that you've positively applied some of this information towards implementing your own solutions, I would love to hear about them. Please send that through the contact form, and we will try to highlight at least one such story in each episode of Questions for Corbett. And we're going to start off today with a comment from Tim that I got that I really enjoyed, so I wanted to share it with you. Tim writes, "I wanted to let you know that I wiped my Dell laptop clean and loaded Ubuntu onto it. Man, what a great move that was. I went back and watched the episode about alternatives and technology and checked out Ubuntu and Prism Break and then jumped ship. I have been fed up with Windows for years with all the virus issues and strange hard drive activity. And after learning over the last 5 years what they actually have access to when you're running Windows, it's despicable. Not to mention my disdain for the eugenicist scumbag himself, Bill Gates. What a great feeling it is to be off that psycho's software. I had many fears when getting ready to do this, and was really concerned about certain pieces of hardware not working or needing special drivers, etc. Well, I basically had one minor hiccup with the wireless card, which I instantly found a cure on an Ubuntu forum. Everything else worked right off the bat, without having to do anything. The layout is clean and easy to use. I would almost call it a cross between Windows and Mac, heavy on the Mac. The other really cool thing that I noticed was that my hard drive indicator, which seemed to always be really busy before with Windows, constantly doing whatever Windows does, is now quiet and peaceful with a blip and flash every now and then. I think I've liberated my hard drive." All right, excellent comment. Thank you so much for sharing that experience, Tim. And I hope that this will be something that we can all learn from as we start to transition off of the architecture that they've placed us on and towards a more free open source software and hardware that hopefully we can use to transition into a completely different technological paradigm and one that is not controlled by the insiders and eugenicists and globalist connected elite, so-called would-be elite. All right, let's move straight into some questions, and we've got some questions related to economics up first. So let's go to Hussein, who writes, Can the Federal Reserve print as much money as they want? In case this is possible, why does the U.S. have a huge debt? Can they print money to pay their debt in U.S. dollars? Okay, excellent question. This is a very important question, and one that I understand a lot of people have, because it's never ever made clear. They never really explain what's happening when they talk about the national debt in the national news, the talking heads talking about the debt ceiling and all of this sort of thing. All of this is just assumed knowledge, but for myself personally, it took a long time before I ever bothered to look this up for myself, which was the only way I ever actually learnt it. So let's get into this, because it is a good question. Can the Federal Reserve just print money till the cows come home? Well, in the end, yes, they can. They can create as much money as they want. But how then does the U.S. government go into debt? Well, the trick is that, of course, that the Treasury isn't the one that's printing the money. It's the Federal Reserve, the separate central bank. They're not the same. They're not linked. They are separate. And the Federal Reserve is not beholden to any part of government, as Alan Greenspan told us not too long ago, and he should know, I suppose. So there it is. That's the disconnect, and that's it's done for this reason. Supposedly, the official story is that, well, you don't want the Treasury just printing as much money as it needs to fulfill its debt obligations, because then you're just monetizing the debt, and it doesn't look good for international investors, it doesn't look good for the optics, etc., if you're just monetizing the debt, basically, because then the government can print as much money as they want, and they will print as much money as they need in order to secure votes, etc., and then you have runaway hyperinflation, blah, blah, blah. So that's the official story of how and why that works and why there's that disconnect between the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. And the Treasury administers most of its money through the Federal Reserve. They have an account at the Federal Reserve through which they disperse most of the funds that they send out to outsiders, etc., etc. So it's an interesting system. There's some intricacies to it. I understand this, so I'm actually going to put together an episode coming up as we approach the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve Act. I think we do need to get into more of the mechanics of how this works, because it's all very important, and it can be interesting just to know how money works and where it comes from. On a related question, we also had this in from Alf, who writes, "Who is the federal government in debt to? I guess it is private pockets the system is leaking to. How else could this balance? Is there a chart that shows the other side of the debt?" Okay, another excellent question that goes straight to the heart of the issue that, again, is completely avoided in the mainstream talking head media. So this is another important issue, and it's important to note that the Treasury issues two different types of securities. And, of course, the Treasury funds what it's doing by issuing T-notes, bills, treasuries, that are then bought by people, and they pay off an interest on that after so many years or months or however long the length of that treasury is for. So the standard by which we judge the interest rates of the federal government is the 10-year treasury note. So in 10 years, you'll get X percent interest on your notes. So this is the way that the Treasury funds its actions, and basically they just sell it on an open market in an auction, and whoever buys it, buys it. The largest holder of treasuries is, in fact, the U.S. government itself. There are two types of treasuries. There are marketable securities, those that they sell to in the auctions to the outside world, and then ones that they issue to themselves to fund government programs. And the largest recipient of that is Social Security, which currently has $2.7 trillion in securities. So $2.7 trillion of that $16 trillion debt that we're always talking about is, in fact, just Social Security. And other government programs make up another $2-2.5 trillion. So something in the order of $5 trillion of that is debt that is technically owed to the government itself. It's a bizarre system. Another $4-5 trillion on top of that, I'll get you the exact figures. In fact, I have a handy infographic that I'll link up here. According to this infographic, as of March 2012, $5.1 trillion was owed to other nations which buy U.S. treasuries as a form of foreign reserves. And the largest holders of that are China and Japan, with about $1.3 and $1.1 trillion, respectively. And then it drops off sharply to the number three spot on that list. And I'll link that list up so you can see exactly what foreign reserve holdings there are in U.S. treasuries. And other than that, those are the main holdings of U.S. debt, the U.S. government itself, and the foreign reserves. But let's not forget that the largest single creditor of the United States in the last couple of years has become the Federal Reserve, because yes, they are buying treasuries directly. Well, not directly from the Treasury. They are buying it on the open market, but they are buying treasuries in the quantitative easing program now to the tune of $40 billion plus a month. So they're adding to their balance books apace, and they now currently have on their books over $2 trillion in securities. So over $2 trillion of that debt is owed to the Federal Reserve. Interesting how this all works. So again, I think we do need to go into the mechanics of this in greater detail. So I will hopefully put together an episode or even a couple of episodes as we approach the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve Act, so we can all understand this system a little bit better and how it really functions. Let's get into a YouTube question. This one from Sam Murphy. And let's let him ask the question.
Hi, James. I just wanted to ask, what do you think about the rise of fascism in Greece, especially with the Golden Dawn Party becoming the third most popular party? It's been described as well-organized, which I assume means that it's well-funded. Do you think they're getting funded perhaps for a full-out war to occur, or maybe perhaps to counter the rise in popularity of anarchism in Greece at the moment? It'd be great to hear your thoughts on this.
All right, thank you for that question. Very good question, an important question, one that I thought about myself. Obviously, the historical parallels are there with a Germany that was going through economic crisis in the 1930s and the rise of the Nazi Party, and now we have the economic crisis that's sweeping through Greece and the Eurozone generally, and we see the rise of right-wing nationalist fascist party. So the historical parallels are definitely there. And I think it's an interesting thing to ponder. I certainly don't have any definitive answer about this. I think that it is probably not necessarily something that's been engineered so much as it's something that does arise out of the economic conditions. But it, certainly the effect is absolutely to counteract any nascent, anarchist tendencies that the Greek public might be working through at the moment. And I've talked a few times now on the podcast about the volos, the currency that has been basically devised as a way of countering the problem of lack of euros floating around Greece, and the local exchange currency that they're playing with in volos, that is truly starting to help communities get through this rough patch. It's an extremely exciting concept, and it would be very much a shame to see ideas like that being superseded by the puppet show that's going on between the political factions that are fighting it out right now in Greece, and with the latest being that the Golden Dawn party members who are actually in the Greek parliament have had their immunity lifted so they can actually be prosecuted while sitting in parliament. It's a crazy situation, and I think to a certain extent it probably is, if not designed to, at least it is distracting from the real solutions that the Greek people are working out for themselves. So that is to the detriment of the Greeks generally. Let's move on to Anointed Samurai, who writes, "My city, Nairobi, has been attacked by a group called Al-Shabaab, apparently due to Kenya's forces being in Somalia. Just wanted to know what you thought with regards to this being linked to U.S. hegemony, geopolitics, and disinformation. What questions should Kenyans be asking so we do not go to war unnecessarily as Obama's lapdogs?" A very important question, so thank you for that, and good to see that there are listeners really literally all over the world to this program. Al-Shabaab, yes, is just another one of these groups that is being rolled out onto the stage right now to make its appearance, along with all the other terrorist groups that are rolled out from time to time as needed, whether it be a Lashkar-e-Taiba or a LFIG or in Syria we have the Al-Nusra Front or whatever it is. They'll roll it out, they'll say it's Al-Qaeda affiliated and it's the justification for going in and bombing a country to smithereens, or it's the good guys, as in the case in Syria, who are helping to liberate that country from Assad, or whatever the official propaganda is. So this is another one that's been rolled out recently, and it is equally ridiculous when you start peeling back the layers of this propaganda onion, including the Samantha Luthwaite, who is the the White Widow, one of the 7-7 bombers, the alleged bombers of 7-7, who is now apparently running around North Africa with 3 children in tow and somehow evading all of the security agencies that are looking for her because she's now an avowed terrorist going around participating in this mall raid and things like this. It just gets stupider and stupider. So, unfortunately, yes, I think that this is very much related to not just necessarily US, but US, British, Israeli, you name it. They've got their fingers in this pie, and they all want a piece of that African puzzle. And I think that there's a lot of resources being invested in that right now. And just as China is trying to go in and bribe countries into their basket with infrastructure deals and the like, so the US and their cronies are, as always, going in with bombs and going after threats that they themselves have created and fostered and funded and hyped up. So yes, I would be extremely cautious about this, and I would resist in any way I could the becoming an Obama lapdog in the creation of AFRICOM, which is just, again, just a few steps down the road, which is what I think they're ultimately seeking for. And again, I think we should do more work on that in the future on this podcast. Let's move on to Sharif, who writes a very important question. How are we to construct any new society, given that approximately 4 of every 100 people are psychopaths? In another podcast, you review how society is inherently vulnerable to psychopaths who naturally rise to power by virtue of their psychopathic qualities. The new society is to be one without all these corrupt institutions, be they financial, educational, governmental, or military. But in such a society, there will be psychopaths who will do terrible things, and we will need to devise an institution to protect ourselves from them, which sounds like police/military. Do you think it will be possible in a future new society to manage the psychopaths among us? Again, thank you so much for this question, Sharif. It is an extremely important one, and one that I think is one of the very, very major challenges in the transition into a free society, because I think it's in the transition that all of the problems lie. A free society would be wonderful, but getting there is extremely difficult to even contemplate. And there are those who will tell you that basically human nature will become different once we live in a free society, and that psychopathy won't really exist or will only be some, you know, rare freak of nature. I'm not so confident in that. I'd like to believe that to be the case, but I haven't studied specifically epigenetics as it relates to psychopathy enough to be able to say where the science says that is right now. I certainly do believe that psychopathy is something that, like any other condition, can be placed in a context that aggravates it, that activates certain genetic tendencies, that fosters and creates that tendency in people. And so I think that there could be a societal context that at least lowers the rate of psychopathy in the population. Although, then again, I haven't studied the science behind that enough to be able to say either way. So that's, I think, another ripe topic for conversation in the future on this program. But long story short, no, I think there will probably always be that psychopathic element. But to my mind, that's exactly why we shouldn't be creating these institutions, these police and these military, that are going to protect us from the psychopaths, because that is exactly where the psychopaths will go. They will assert their power, they will get into the positions of power in those institutions. That is exactly how the psychopaths function, the high functioning psychopaths in our society. The Rockefellers, or you name it, are the ones that always go for where the power is and infest that and take it over and use it as a tool, which is exactly why we have to get rid of these overarching institutions, which are always used as a tool to ultimately repress the people. It is always a weapon that is ultimately used against the people themselves by the psychopaths. So I think we have to get rid of these overarching institutions rather than waiting for these institutions to save us, as if the police and the military have ever done anything to save us from the psychopaths in power. It's always the psychopaths that rise to the top of those institutions. Again, a lot more to say about that topic, so thank you so much for that question, Sharif. Let's move on to Corey. If global warming is a scam being foisted upon us, why would the global elite go to the trouble to use chemtrails to dim the skies to prevent global warming? If the global warming isn't the life-threatening emergency we've been led to believe, why bother having a covert operation to keep it from happening? Okay, very good question. But this question, I think, swallows hook, line, and sinker the assumption that chemtrails really are about dimming the globe and preventing global warming. This is the type of propaganda they're trying to seed us with right now, so that when they finally announced, oh yeah, we're doing geoengineering, we've been doing it for a while, here are the programs, here's the aerosol spraying we've been doing, and it's all to prevent global warming. That's the propaganda narrative that they want to implant in the population, so that when they reveal it to the population, everyone will go, oh, okay, it's all right, it's for our good anyway. Because as I've mentioned before, this is always, always the way propaganda is rolled out. First, they deny, deny, deny. That doesn't exist. You're crazy. Don't look up at the sky. Don't talk about this. You're wrong. You're just insane. And then eventually it'll flip like a switch and they'll go, yeah, of course it exists, but it's for the best. It's for our good. Why are you complaining about this? That is always the way this propaganda is rolled out. And that's why they're implanting that idea right now. Oh, well, geoengineering would be in order to dim the globe so that global warming won't take over. I don't think that's ultimately what it's about. I mean, I think there are a lot of different uses for this technology, including being able to bounce HAARP off the ionosphere more effectively, and all of the health effects, and all of the Monsanto patenting crops that are resistant to the bariums and the salts and the other things that are infested in these aerosols. So there's a lot of reasons behind this, and I don't think global warming is one of them. I think that's just a propaganda narrative they're throwing out. Let's turn to Twitter. We had a tweet in from @SeaDevil. Was Fast and Furious a gift from the U.S. government to drug lords? Strange there is no spillover on the border. Well, I mean, ask someone on the border whether there's been spillover. I think that the fact that Mexico is basically a failed state at this point and is just complete chaos and is being run by drug mafia does have its toll on certainly the border towns with the U.S. So, I mean, ask someone in El Paso whether there's been some spillover. But on to the point of the whether this was the U.S. government's gift to the drug lords, absolutely, it certainly was. And again, the U.S. government turns out time and time again to be in bed and infested and in every layer of these drug mafia, drug cartels. There was a whistleblower from the Sinaloa cartel who came out to say that basically, yes, the DEA was cutting deals with that cartel in order to cut out some of the other competition to the drug trade, etc. And that was covered by, that is still being covered excellently by Bill Conroy of Narco News, who I've talked to a couple of times. And we have talked about this issue. We talked about Fast and Furious, so I will include a link to our Fast and Furious conversation in the show notes of this Questions for Corbett, so you can go and watch that, where we talk a little bit more about this and some of the insider information about what was really happening there with Fast and Furious and the way that the DEA was basically infesting the drug cartels. Surprise, surprise. Let's turn to another YouTube question. This one in from YouTube user Dick Trump.
James Dick Trump here. My question for you, first and foremost, thank you for the work that you've done with the 9/11 evidence presentation on YouTube. I think that you've been viral to the point of now Jesse Ventura quotes you verbatim and may launch a presidential candidacy based on your research. But what you don't do is make a conclusion. And I'm wondering if you might have a handful of conclusions that you could draw from the evidence that you have put together, because I think anyone could look at it, but no one's looked at it as closely as you have. So what do you think? Are there blanket statements like Maurice Greenberg was a double agent between the CIA and the Mossad, or something that you could say with definitive proof, or something that's definitively not true? You know, definitely wasn't George Bush, or probably wasn't George Bush. Are there places you could point us in the direction where you're leaning to give us a feeling of what really happened? Because I think you've done a lot to expose the evidence. I think it's time we hear your theory. So I'd love to hear it. Thanks.
All right, thank you for the question. I think you're exactly right. Of course, in my 9/11 conspiracy theory video, it didn't posit a conspiracy theory of any sort. It didn't posit any sort of theory, which is kind of the irony of the title, the pointing out the fact that the official conspiracy theory is a conspiracy theory, and a ridiculous one at that. That was the point of that video, so it didn't offer anything definitive about what did or didn't occur on that day. But that's not to say that I haven't covered in a great degree of detail before what we can definitively say about 9/11, both what did occur and what did not occur, and we could make a checklist of various things. We could talk about the insider trading that did occur, and that's been documented in business journals even. We can talk about the transactions that were being done through the computer systems. We can talk about the stand down that in the air defenses, and the fact that the 9/11 Commission was even going to bring criminal charges against people in the Pentagon for lying to the 9/11 Commission about the NORAD timeline. We can talk about, again, there are many definitive points we can make about 9/11, but rather than me just reiterating them all, I will direct you to my 9/11 work, specifically my work on the 9/11 money trail, and my recent episodes on 9/11, the 9/11 anniversary, and the 9/11 suspects that we should be bringing forward criminal charges against, so that we can start the real criminal investigation. So that's what I'll say at this point. Again, there's my 9/11 work has talked about this a lot in the past, so I hope you'll look into some of it in the archives of CorbettReport.com. Let's move on to the next question from Benjamin, who writes, do you think martial law in America is imminent, considering your long preparations of FEMA and DHS appear seem to be hotting up right now, and telling by the tiptoe removal of civil and constitutional rights? Will it possibly culminate with the GridX 2 exercise scheduled for November 11th through 14th, just like 9/11 and 7/7 have been mingled with exercises? Could it be that the currency collapse is scheduled just for that time, or is it all hype, fear-mongering, and bogus? Okay, excellent question, Benjamin. This is a question that I think everyone has when they first start getting into this information and realizing what's really going on behind the scenes, and I certainly had that when I first got into this as well. And I think you'll find that reflected in some of my earlier work in this podcast, focusing on every exercise that came along. Oh, well, what if this one went live? Or focusing on the FEMA camp idea and things like that. It's not to say that this couldn't happen, and it couldn't happen overnight. It certainly could. Could you imagine in the wake of the next large-scale terrorist event, if a nuke or dirty nuke or whatever it is goes off in some major city in the United States, can you imagine the results of that? And you know, all bets would be off the table, whether that would start the actual martial law roundup, which there have been preparations ongoing for years about, and I covered that in my video, U.S. Army Prepares to Invade U.S., which is my second most popular video, almost 2 million views. So yes, I have definitely covered those preparations in the past, and they definitely do exist, and there definitely could be the possibility of that going live. But I think the more that I get into this, and I notice from other people as well, the more that they get into this and the more they study it, the less likely they are to see this happening around every single corner. And again, GridX 2 exercise, etc., etc. One thing that I've learned over the years is there is no possible way to predict what exercises will be used as exercises and what exercises will go live as part of an event. And again, they could run thousands, millions of exercises that just go off as exercises, and it just takes the one that goes live that becomes a 9/11 or what have you. So again, there's no possible way to predict it. And could it be that that November 11th will be scheduled with the economic collapse and GridX and all of this? It could certainly be. Am I betting the farm on that? Certainly not. Again, I don't have the crystal ball on this. So my philosophy is that we have to do as much as we can to prepare while we have this time to prepare. And that means implementing the real solutions that we constantly talk about on this podcast, including getting onto the alternative local currencies, getting into the agorism, getting into open source architecture, software, hardware, ideas, projects. We've covered all of these types of solutions in the past, and I think that they are absolutely what we should be concentrating on, more so than worrying about when the hammer is going to drop on martial law, because again, that's not something that we have any control over. And I think ultimately, if I was in charge of the New World Order and puppeteering all of this, it would be infinitely more effective for them to incrementally bring us into this, just step by step, generation by generation, as they have been doing for a long time. The big spectacular 9/11s, etc., tend to wake people up mighty fast and in mighty large numbers, as we have all seen in the last several years. So I think it would be in their interest not to go with the hot martial law scenario, just to bring it in a little bit at a time. And that is what they're doing. I mean, we are already in a stage of martial law when you look at the implementation of it in the United States specifically. It's just, it's not 100% open, declared FEMA camp type martial law. It's just more and more the police are becoming the military. So a lot more to be said there, and again, we'll cover it in the future in greater detail. Let's get to a couple more questions. We're running out of time, but one from Robert, who writes, why is the Plaingate affair worth focusing on? And I'm glad someone just simply asked this question, because this, for people who don't know, I've been covering the Plaingate affair and the reality behind the Plaingate affair for the last several weeks on the Eye Opener Report, and whatever my intentions with this series are, I have fallen far, far short of the mark, as I've noticed that this series has gotten absolutely no interest or attention from anyone, which is disappointing, because this is something that that I've been talking about with Sabelle behind the scenes for weeks now. We've been preparing this and trying to figure out the best way to roll this out and introduce this topic and these characters and the ideas, because this story actually goes straight into the heart of Sabelle Edmonds' story and the story of what she was dealing with in the FBI as a whistleblower, talking about these characters like Mark Grossman, who were involved with this nuclear espionage and passing secrets to foreign operatives, and all of this right in the heart of government that we have firsthand from a whistleblower, from inside one of the bowels of one of the intelligence agencies there, that is coming out to say this at great personal risk to herself, and no one even cares. So the Plaingate affair goes straight into the heart of that with these characters and the real story of how Valerie Plame's cover was not blown in 2003. It didn't come from Dick Armitage. It came from Mark Grossman in 2001, who blew the lid off of Brewster Jennings. That is the real scandal, and that is monstrous in and of itself. The ramifications of this are just huge. The fact that there is a nuclear espionage ring that is operating in the heart of the State Department, that has these players who are still rotating in and around and involved with government in various ways, they are still there, they are still operating to this day, this is still going on, and people just don't even care about it. So that is my fault. What I have clearly not found the way to express this properly to the public. So as always, I'll encourage anyone out there who understands, who sees the picture that I'm trying to paint here and can do a better job, please do so, because this is an important story, and I have no doubt that if you are able to do so, Sabelle would be happy to host or to link to that on her site, and I would be happy to draw people's attention to it, because it is a very important story. That's what I'll say about that for now, and we are completely out of time, so just one final question in from Kang, who writes, in your broadcast area where you make your vids, there is a red paddle thing with a little ball hanging on a string, looks like a toy musical instrument hand drum. It has been in the same place forever, LOL, and I would love to know what it is, and sure lots of others would too. Yes, it's a little Japanese toy. It makes a noise, and I just thought it looked cool, and I bought it at a shrine here a number of years ago. I don't even know how much. And in fact, there's also another Japanese little thing there in the background, but maybe we could save that for another Questions for Corbett. On that note, that's going to be it for today. Sorry it's a lightning fast tour, and once again, sorry I can't get back to everyone who writes in, and I can't answer every question that comes in, but I do appreciate your comments and questions, and I do try to read everything that comes in. So please keep sending your contact in through CorbettReport.com. Use hashtag QFC on YouTube, on Twitter to get your questions in that way. Use Audioboo or SoundCloud to record yourself asking a question. However you get your questions in, I will do my best to answer them to the best of my ability. Thank you as always for tuning in, and please bear with me over the next week or two as I continue to have a much reduced level of media coming out at CorbettReport.com, but I'm looking forward to stepping that back up in early November. And also thank you, of course, to the people who've put in your DVD orders, and I am doing my best to burn them off and get them out, but it is going slowly, so for anyone who's still waiting on a DVD order, please hang in there. I will get them out in the next several days, and I will send you an email once it has been shipped to you. Also, if you have a problem with your DVDs, if there's been an error, if your DVD doesn't play, just let me know. I'm happy to replace them. Just send me an email to let me know that your DVD is malfunctioning. At any rate, that's going to do it. Thank you again. CorbettReport.com. See you again next week. And one more thing. Sorry, James here once again. I am just about to publish this Questions for Corbett, but it is currently Monday the 21st of October, which is the third Monday of the month, so I am definitely not going to be able to get to Film Literature and the New World Order this month. So if you have already read this month's selection, which is Rudyard Kipling's Kim, then you're already ahead of the game. And if you haven't read it yet, well, you still have time to prepare as we get ready to go over it in next month's Film Literature in the New World Order coming up in November. So sorry about that, guys. I do hope that things will be going back to normal later this month towards the beginning of November, and we will get everything back up and running as normal. And I plan at this point to have a podcast up for this coming week, but we will see how it goes, and we'll just leave it at that. So thank you once again for tuning in. I'm looking forward to talking to you again real soon.